You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon, I'm Louis Sines, your host for The Weekend, and joining us today is a good friend of the station's and a good friend of mine, Stephanie Townsend-Ayala, and we're going to talk about, well, some of the issues that we all face and sometimes are afraid to face, but we're going to get into that in just a minute. But first of all, we'd like to welcome Stephanie to the studio. Stephanie, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Louis. I'm so happy to be here today. There's so many things happening in the area of elder law and elder care and wills, powers of attorney, and I'm really excited to be here to talk about it.
I guess the number one, I wouldn't say it's the number one, but it's a thing that comes up a lot. When people talk about wills, they'll say, well, I don't need to make one because I don't have a lot of money or I don't have a big estate. But that's one of the biggest mistakes that people make.
When people say I need a will, what I'm hearing as an estate planning attorney is you need an essential estate planning package. And today, an essential estate planning package consists of 7 legal documents that no one should either live or die without. These 7 legal documents help remove all doubt and worry, concern about what's supposed to happen, not if, but when you become disabled or die. And so what we talk about is the first one is a durable power of attorney for finances. That's where you name somebody to handle your money when you're too sick to do it. The second is a medical power of attorney for medical decisions. You name somebody to make your medical choices. Choose your doctor, choose your nursing home, choose your hospital. The third is a HIPAA, and that's just a document concerning the Health Information Portability and Privacy Act that makes hospitals and other medical facilities feel better about releasing the information to your agents. The fourth, then, is a declaration of a guardianship in case of future need. Actually, that's fifth. And so those 5 documents, the declaration of a guardianship in case of future need says, if a court ever gets involved in my life, these are the people I want to be my guardians. And you can say that now while you're healthy. A lot of people don't understand why we have that one document because they think, why, you know, we have a power of attorney. Why do I need a guardianship? But powers of attorney are self-naming. So you yourself name them, and they're also revocable, and they sometimes fail, and for many different reasons. So the guardianship is sort of a super power of attorney. It's where the court appoints it. The court names people, and the court's involved. You don't want to go do that. Obviously, nobody wants to get involved in a court proceeding if they don't have to. That's why you want to have well-made powers of attorney. There's no law that says anyone ever has to honor a power of attorney. So you just make them nicely enough and well enough so that a bank will honor them, a hospital will honor them, any facility will honor them. And my powers of attorney are 8 pages long right now, and I'm thinking of extending them and making them a little longer. But every word in there is vitally important for your agent to be able to execute your wishes the way you want. Really, what we're talking about here is the law of substituted judgment. I'm going to substitute my judgment for yours when you're too sick to say what you want. So how do I do that? Through these legal documents I'm mentioning and through knowing you well enough as a friend, as a family member, so that I know when it comes to time and they say, hey, she's in a vegetative state, should we pull the plug or keep her in? I've already talked to you about it. I already know you. I know what you would want, and I'm able to do that. And so those first 5 documents that I just mentioned, those are the foundation of the essential estate planning package. The last 2 are for when you're gone, and that's the last will and testament, who gets your stuff, and then control of the remains, and that's who's in charge of the funeral. When I started doing this 14 years ago, my speech was about the 5 legal documents that no one should live or die without. And as we've seen technology change and as we've seen people change and society change, we've had to add that last one, we've added the HIPAA, we've added the and the control of the remains. That one was added, and I have to say that Sherman Hemsley is the reason I added that to my documents. He was an actor, and he lived in El Paso and passed away here. And even though he created his estate planning documents that were very well done, his attorney didn't tell him about this control of the remains document, or I'm sure he would have signed one. But because he didn't sign one, his body was on ice for many, many months while family members fought over it in the probate court here in El Paso. And so the law in Texas says there's a funeral home law that says if a funeral home director or somebody at a funeral home is told that there is an argument over who's in charge of the funeral, they're required by Texas law to put that body on ice and wait until there's a court order on what to do. And that's tragic in many cases. I have people who've passed who still haven't had services or funerals because the children are fighting and one has ashes and the other one has ashes and nobody will get together to do it. So in order to take the doubt away, we create these 7 legal documents. And in that estate planning package, it therein lies the gold, because we've removed all doubt. We've named the people that you want to have to make your substituted judgment decisions. And you've removed the elements that lead to expensive, difficult probate contests or challenges in court. When somebody says they want to sue their brother or sister, oftentimes there's very good, sound legal reason to do it. However, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. And so the impact, I think, for some of my families that come in and they're in trauma, they're in the middle of depression and loss and fear and anxiety, and maybe not making the decisions that they would make if they weren't in the middle of that trauma. And I have told some clients before that I think your money would be better spent on a therapist than an attorney, because some of these things, when you come into my office saying, I'm going to sue because it's the principle of the thing. Well, that's expensive. And what about when your sibling's child graduates from college? Are you going to even be invited to that graduation as a result of this conflict in the lawsuit? What happens to weddings and future funerals and future family gatherings? What cost are you paying when you choose to take that stand? And so I want to let people know that the court system, when it comes to probate, guardianship, stuff like that, the court system really is only designed to deal with money. If you want advice about people say, what should I do? I always say, well, I can only tell you what's legal. You know, what you should do is above my pay grade. But there are many things you should consider before doing anything. And one of them is the personal, emotional, family relationship costs. Because once you've spent 40, 50 grand, 100 grand to sue a sibling or a family member, that's just the beginning of the cost.
And sometimes people, because they're in such an emotional state, sometimes they don't understand. And you and I were in television news for a while, so we had to kind of decipher what some of these people said, whether it be military, medical, or even legal terms. And sometimes these people get overwhelmed and they go, oh, I didn't know that was what you were saying, or I didn't know this is what this meant. So what advice would you give somebody about not being intimidated by some of these big words and things that they don't understand, that they should ask questions?
There's no such thing as a bad question. That's the first thing. We learned that as journalists, and I continue that as an attorney. It's very important that you ask me questions. I have to say, I spend a lot of my time with my clients answering questions. And I'm so grateful for them, because even though I've answered the same question probably thousands of times in my practice, it's new for this person. And I take that to heart. This is the first time this person has had an attorney in front of them. And many times I'm the only attorney they've ever met. And so you ask questions, be a good consumer. Don't just go in and listen to them. And I have seen attorneys who do all the talking in a conference. I tried an 80-20 rule. I always have an 80-20 rule. I want, if I'm talking more than 20% in an initial client conference, then there's something wrong. I need to just be responding to the questions, but mostly listening. And so you want to find a lawyer, to answer your question, you want to find a lawyer who listens, someone who will take the time to hear your story. We all have stories. And basically, as an attorney, I'm taking this, the basic foundation of law, but then I have to listen to you in order to shape that law, in order to change it and modify it so that it meets your needs, so that it makes you feel better. The whole goal, you know, what I do, I like to call myself a bridge. I'm a bridge to the to death and the everlasting, whatever you believe. I'm a bridge to that. And I want to walk across the bridge to help you remove your doubts and sleep better so that you know when you die, this is what's going to happen. And there won't be a fight because you put it in black and white. And so in building that bridge, I can't do it without listening. If you go to a lawyer who just wants to build the bridge without getting input from you, then go someplace else because you have to be heard. And that's the key. One of the things that people are not being heard about right now is the fear of going to a nursing home. That's on the mind of many, many of my clients. And there's very few lawyers who are even qualified to talk to them and to give them advice about this nursing home move. And in the context of nursing homes, for the average El Pasoan, you cannot be in a nursing home unless you have Medicaid. There's two ways to pay for a nursing home. Either you're a millionaire and you can pay the $6,000 a month or whatever it is, or you have Medicaid cover it. So if you're in a city like El Paso, you can imagine the people who have $6,000 a month are much fewer than those who have Medicaid. Here's the problem. The state of Texas started a program called the Medicaid Estate Recovery Program. And in that program in 2005, they said, hey, folks, go ahead and take your Medicaid, but we might come steal your home when you die. So other states have the same or similar programs, but Texas has implemented it in one of the stingiest, meanest, harshest ways across the state, across the country. Texas is one of the worst, in my perception. Part of it is because they're telling everybody they're going to take their home when there's waivers. And let me say this, and I'm not just, I hate to sound like I'm plugging myself, but I've been doing this since before the Medicaid Estate Recovery Program started. I've never lost a house. I've never lost a home. I've never lost anything to the Medicaid Estate Recovery Program. It's not that I'm the smartest lawyer in the world, but I do work diligently at following the law. And if you read the law carefully, and there's a 5,000-page Medicaid handbook, eligibility handbook, then you understand there are a lot of ways to avoid having your house taken by the Medicaid Estate Recovery Program. So I have had elderly people in my office when I tell them that we've never lost a house, you don't have to lose your home, it's so easy to preserve it, it's easier when you're alive and do something about it, but if somebody didn't do it and they've already passed, we can still posthumously save that home. And so I'll tell somebody this, and literally they will just break out in tears and start sobbing. I've had at least three people tell me in my office they were considering suicide as the only way to overcome the devastating effects of the Medicaid Estate Recovery Program. And when I told them that they didn't have to, what a relief. Almost people dancing out of my office. They're so thrilled to know that the American dream that they worked so hard to get, that they don't have to lose it. They don't have to make a choice, either get the care I need or lose my home. You can do both. And it's so exciting and thrilling. To me, that's the most important part of my law practice, is helping people preserve the American dream, their homes. Get the Medicaid benefits, get the care you need, preserve your home. We're not saving a lot of money here, but it's good for society. If one generation can give a little something to the next generation, that's good public policy. I feel like if I can help preserve the homes for the next generation, I am actually helping raise the tax base in El Paso County by saving these homes. We're raising the tax base. So it's actually, it's an overall good for our community if we can help something pass from one generation to the next.
And some people will say, well, it doesn't really matter because, you know, mom and dad's house is very old and we just need to get rid of it. But that's at the same time, there's a lot of sentimental value there. And there have been stories of homes that have been in families for generations. And the fact that somebody might be afraid of that is a big deal.
I'm from South Texas. I own a tiny piece of land, not huge, that came into my family through a Spanish land grant. So, yeah, that means a lot. So I know what you're talking about. And actually, in El Paso, you'd be surprised how many farmers and ranchers we have on the west and the valley areas. So we have a lot of people who have operating farms and ranches who go into a nursing home. Well, what happens to them? These farms and ranches aren't making a lot of money for them. So we help them get it into shape to where they can get the care they need and the family farm can continue to operate. Again, those are good public policy things. This is so good for our economy. And it's hard to believe that one estate plan, you know, elder law firm could actually do something to help the economy. But if we think about it in a bigger context of what we're doing, it's all connected.
Talking about nursing homes, there are a lot of issues, especially with, you know, tradition. People will say, no, when I get older, I don't want to be in anybody's home. I don't want to be a problem. I want to stay in my own house. But then sometimes you do have to move mom and dad or your aunt or your uncle into a nursing home for their own safety.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what is involved in, you know, choosing a nursing home or choosing care for your loved one. And, you know, that grandma, grandpa, or whoever who's making that decision, they'll say, well, you know, I'd rather just stay here in my home. And it could be dangerous.
That's really a good question. You know, nursing homes are not filled with unloved people, okay? They're filled with people who need more care than their loving family can provide at home. And it's the most loving thing to do sometimes is to get your mom or dad or loved one into a facility where they can get the care they need. But El Paso has one of the lowest nursing home ratios to populations of any county in the nation, and even lower than my hometown county of Cameron County in South Texas, even lower. We in El Paso will keep grandpa on a hospital gurney in the living room if we have to, because we believe that only, you know, you only send somebody there if you don't love them. And so we're dealing with that, and that's an issue. But so if you want, get your pencil out, because I'm going to give you some information real quickly. So I want to say get a pen, get something to write with right now, because this is very important. When you ask me the question about how to find a nursing home, I encourage you to just do a search on the internet, Quality Review Survey, Texas. If you do Quality Review Survey, QRS, Texas, just do QRS, Texas. It'll come up. You'll get the Department of Aging and Disability Services quality review reports on all nursing homes in the state that take Medicaid and Medicare. And so you can click down and do the drop-down menu, and it'll say which county, and you'll say what kind of facility are you looking for, and you want to look for all freestanding skilled nursing facilities that accept Medicare and Medicaid. And they also have, you can search assisted living, you can search foster homes, but those are the ones that we search. And so you go, you click on that, and it brings up all 17 nursing homes in the El Paso County, and it has all of their reviews. It scores them on a basis from 0 to 100. And then you can click on each one of the name, and then it'll give you their individual score, because the main page will just give you each nursing home and their score. And then once you click on the name of the nursing home, it'll tell you why and what happened. Many times when you go down and look at the reports of what happened, they have charts, and they qualify the seriousness of the problems 1, 2, 3, and 4. So 1 and 2 could be somebody had boxes in front of a fire escape. No big deal. But it's stuff that needs to be taken care of. Threes and fours mean somebody either was severely hurt or died. And so somebody suffered physically. So you want to go into each individual nursing home and see if there's too many threes or fours. You want, ones and twos I'm not going to get worried about, but threes and fours should be seriously looked at. So that's how you do the QRS reports at the state provided by the Department of Aging and Disability Services. And they tell you. Also, there's a Medicare site that ranks them as well. The one in Texas is done based on the Texas. They come once a year to do review. Reviews. They come into the state, will come and just sit in the facility for a week or two. And then the second basis upon which they score you is number of complaints.
Some people have a question about a nursing home and assisted living. And, you know, there are big differences, and there are some, again, good and bad, depending on what you're looking for. And some are very expensive, and some, you know, if they have the insurance, as you mentioned earlier, it's going to work out perhaps.
It's very complicated, and it's confusing because SNF is it's an important term. Skilled nursing facility is what you want to find if you're looking for a nursing home. SNF. We have a lot of assisted living centers in El Paso, though, who have put in lockdown units for people with dementia. And so we have assisted livings with lockdown units that kind of make you think they're a SNF. So you need to not get confused about that because, again, Medicaid will pay for a SNF. Medicaid will not pay for an assisted living facility. So that's the whole difference between being able to get Medicaid coverage for your care in a SNF and being on your own at an assisted living facility, which is, you know, it's fine for a lot of people and it's the best place for a lot of people. But it's important that you're aware of the difference between nursing homes and assisted living. And those assisted living facilities are looking more and more like nursing homes every day. The difference being they don't have a requirement to have a 24-hour nurse on call or staff. They don't get investigated and they don't have the level of scrutiny that a skilled nursing facility does. That's important to know. And it's nothing against assisted living. Like I said, they're perfect. They're the best answer for many, many people. But if you're going to make a choice, have your eyes open about it.
As far as applying and finding all these things, sometimes adult child,
right,
will go in there and they'll want to help out mom and dad. And sometimes, you know, the mom and dad will be very cooperative. But the other times is, we know, and we've seen movies, television shows, whatever, where mom and dad are set in their ways. And, you know, no, I know what it's going to go. And I don't want an attorney. I don't want any fancy. And it's probably from, you know, some of the old movies that we've seen. And it's more important now as far as like, okay, as you mentioned earlier, what happens if mom or dad has a stroke and they're in a coma, they're on a respirator? What should we do? What should we not do? And you're always going to have a division there between the family.
You're right. You know, it's funny. I like to say that when I went to law school, I got a doctorate of jurisprudence. Since then, I've received a PhD in grumpy people. I deal with grumpy. That's my thing. I do grumpy well. And so if you're going to be in this practice, then you have to be able to navigate those relationships and navigate and learn about psychology and how to help people with dementia. How you don't tell somebody with dementia that they're wrong. You try to make them feel better. How do you deal with somebody with these elder issues in a way that lessens their suffering, doesn't add to their suffering? And so that's super important that we have the language and the skills and the ability to say, okay, I understand what you're saying here. Let's think about this. And I've had a lot of folks who have made their life and death much harder on their children because they refuse to do the basic things that they should and could have done. And their poor kids suffer greatly. They suffer, their families suffer greatly when somebody takes a hard line and says, I'm not going to make a will. Well, you have children from five people. And so now you have a ranch. And who's going to, you know, you've just created a situation for lawyers to make a couple hundred grand.
And sometimes what you just mentioned, people, again, because of movies, because of television, they think only people who need a will are people who have big estates, a big ranch, or sometimes they think of, well, you know, they have a lot of money, so it's not a big deal, and I'm sure that grandpa and grandma are going to leave it to the four kids, or it's the other way around where it's somebody who lives in a three-room house, and they're the ones who do have a will and do everything, and it and everything works out.
Right. And so when people tell me that, they say, well, I don't need to make a will. I don't have anything. I say, well, what if you leave my office and a concrete company truck hits you and kills you? Somebody's going to get paid for that. Who do you want to be in charge? Who's going to get paid for that? You don't know. You might go have an accident and go to the hospital and a doctor makes a mistake. How do you know? We have no way of knowing. So please don't tell me that you don't have anything. That is not a good excuse. That's just one of those check-the-box excuses for why I haven't done my estate planning yet. You know, why haven't you? Why haven't you prepaid your funeral? You know you're going to die. Do you really want your wife and children, while they're in the grief, the suffering and sorrow of your immediate loss, to have to go make a $10,000 decision? That's not logical.
And a lot of times those decisions are based on emotion, so they spend more than
they
should.
Yeah, if you really loved your mom, you'd get that platinum casket. Mm-hmm. If you really loved your mom, you'd get that extra spray of flowers. So it's just, I've already prepaid my funeral package, and it makes me feel so comfortable knowing that it's been paid. And I provided for an urn. I'm going to be cremated myself. And I've got some titanium now in my body. So I've told my daughters that they don't have to use the urn anymore. If they'd like to have some maracas, make some maracas. You know, that way I could make noise into eternity. But no, there's so many decisions that if we make it, it has a lasting blessing effect on our children and our loved ones. And if we don't, there is a lasting negative effect. And that's the important part.
Stephanie, we want to thank you so much for being with us here today. And again, as you mentioned, it's not that you're endorsing yourself or we're endorsing your business, but it's something that has to be done. And you gave us one of the websites, QRS Texas, to do a search. But if people have additional questions, what is a website perhaps that they should go to help them make a decision about finding an attorney, what they should or should not do, and those seven documents that you talked about?
At elpasoelderlaw.com, ELPASOELDERLAW.com. You can even submit questions. We'll respond to questions online. We're happy to do that. We've had people send in questions and inquiries, and we're happy to respond. Happy. You know, we can't give legal advice through an email, but we're happy to respond to questions. A lot of people do have questions. And there's another website called elderlawanswers.com, and that's a national website. It has some state specific, but not quite as helpful. But elderlawanswers.com also has some good information.
Thank you so much for being with us. We've been visiting with Stephanie Townsend Ayala. And again, if you have additional questions, you can go to elderlaw.com or elpasoelderlaw.com. The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Kim Garcia. Our producer is Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Luis Sainz.